Welcome to Church in the North, a podcast by ministry leaders and for ministry leaders. I'm your host, Rob Chartrand, Program Coordinator for Christian Ministry at Briarcrest College. And I'm joined by my co-host, Jeff Dresser, Assistant Professor of Worship Arts. Welcome, Jeff.
Hey, Rob. Good to be here.
And Dan Goddard, Lead Pastor of Victory Church. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Rob.
Hey, and thanks everyone for joining us in our little chat this morning. Today, before we dive in, we want to encourage you guys to, if you like what you're hearing on our podcast, leave us a review and share your comments, or maybe hit that subscribe button for more great content north of the 49th parallel. Also, if you have suggestions, we'd love to hear about that. So any ideas for topics or guests, or even if you have questions, send us an email, podcast@briarcrest.ca. We'd love to hear from you. Is that not true, guys?
That'd be awesome.
Truth, man.
Truth. Truth. Word.
We love them. We do read every one. So, yeah.
Yeah, we do. We do. We read every one of them. Yeah. Absolutely. Beautiful weather lately. It's nice outside. Actually, it's kind of scary nice. Like, it shouldn't be this nice this time of year. But snow out west, snow out east, and then there's this big gap where we live and there's no snow. It's kind of amazing. So we kind of dodged the bullet there. But I thought, you know, just to kick things off, we do a bit of a prediction. I mean, I've lived in Saskatchewan. I've got snow in July. I can remember that that year. What do you guys think? Between now and July, how many significant snowfalls will we still have between now and then? Dan, any ideas?
I think we've got a couple yet to come. You know, I do.
So
I,
a couple, is that two? Are you declaring?
It is two. That's okay.
Are we going to put money on the table?
We've had a drought in this. We should put money on the table. I mean, this is important, you know, but...
I need to check my institutional covenant to see if I would be allowed to make such a wager.
Anyway.
Of course, joking is not allowed either. Yeah.
It has been a drought around here, really.
Okay.
And so we do need it. So I'm hoping and praying for snow, even if it's a combined rain, snow, something like that. But
yeah, we need it wet. Last year was ridiculous. It was terrible. Yeah. Not just for the farmers, but for my garden.
Yeah.
And that's more important.
Well, it is. So what's your guys' predictions? Yeah. You got to pick a number here.
I'm on two. I think we're going to have two good snowfalls that will last, like that won't melt as soon as it lands. That's going to stay on the ground. So that's what I mean by snowfall. So I think we're going to have two before the summer. Jeff?
I'm taking the under. I'm going with one.
Okay. Go with one?
All right.
So if we're right, we split the winnings?
Yeah, we split the non-bet.
And if you're right, you get like double.
Okay, sure, whatever. That sounds
okay,
good.
Okay.
Double of nothing is still nothing.
I need to sound like I'm unfamiliar with this wagering business here.
Yeah. So Groundhog Day, I mean, it's come and gone. That's February the 2nd. And Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog, did not see his shadow this year, which means an early spring. So he got it right, you know, and I was looking back at the stats and I realized he actually doesn't get it right very often. He's actually batting 400 on this or 40. Yeah. Like, he only gets it right 40% of the time. So I was thinking, like, shouldn't they just flip it? Like, shouldn't they just flip what it means? So when he sees his shadow, you know, that means six more weeks of winter or whatever. Like, shouldn't they flip it around so that he gets 60%?
Is nothing sacred, Rob? That you would reverse how long is the tradition of groundhog?
I don't know. It's hallowed. It's a holy tradition.
A decades-long tradition that you would turn it on its head?
If they flip it, the stats will change. So
you think so?
Yeah. You gotta
keep, I blame climate change for the increased unpredictability.
Okay. Yeah, we can go with that. Yeah. I blame climate change for everything.
It's... it's perhaps slightly less superstitious than Groundhog Day. I don't know. Okay. Yeah. That was maybe a little too-paced.
the views of Jeff Dresser do not reflect the views of this podcast.
All right.
We won't go there. We won't go to climate change. We'll stay away from that topic on this podcast. But on another topic, now we're past Easter, so we're heading towards summer. And, you know, Easter's a lot of work, wouldn't you guys say?
It is. It's an intense season, and it has kind of high highs.
Yeah.
So,
and then now it's springtime. Like, birds are chirping, days are warming up. People want to get outside. People want to get away for weekends. Kids' sports are starting up. School is out. Do you think the best approach now, like between now and the fall startup, like fall startups are going to be crazy busy again, that pastors should maybe just kind of coast? Like, is this a good time to coast? What do you guys think? Jeff, any thoughts on that?
No, you only have like a few weeks before everyone heads to the cottage. So you better get your you better get your ducks in a row for you got some sort of summer kickoffs, you know, church picnic thing you got to plan. And then you better have the decisions made for what kickoff is going to look like because you can't plan that in August. Nobody's around.
Right.
So it's even more important. You got to be on the ball, man. And, yeah. I mean, Christmas is around the corner. If you wait till September to start thinking about Christmas, you're sunk, man.
He's heated up. He's looking at me with a death stare right now as he's talking.
And I'm just retreating into a hole. I'm just, I mean, there is, I actually do somewhat agree with Jeff's strong views there, yeah. but there is rhythm, right? So yeah, I do think after Easter, you know, there's a, just because of what a high moment that is, there's a natural lull, but it is spring. So I think as well, you're headed towards Pentecost and, you know, you've got that spring season. So there is momentum that comes from that that's worth taking advantage of within wise rhythms.
It can't always be up like Easter because Jeff would get sick again because he's got sick this week because of Easter.
Probably just because of his intensity.
Yeah, and, totally. Yeah. He's probably burned out all of his adrenaline in his body.
that did... There's truth to that, but there's also truth to what I was saying, and not that you need the details, but like, you know, in all seriousness, the sort of the big elements of what's coming, you know, I think need to be in place. And depending on the culture of your church, the previous church that I was at, everyone disappeared after Victoria Day.
Right.
And it was so hard to do any kind of planning with a team after that. So I knew that I needed to have my I needed to have the big decisions made about fall kickoff even about Easter plans, like who the major players were going to be and some ideas around a fall series. As well. And it was just so much less work to have that nailed down when everyone's still around. And people are also a lot more willing to say yes to things in in this sort of dreamy spring where they're all optimistic and you're and it's far off.
It's a little ways away.
I'd love to do that. And then, you can you claim that ground in their calendar before other people get to it.
Yeah, we would say to our staff, you've got to recruit your volunteers in May and June for the fall. Do not wait till August. August will be too late. Now, there might be a few straggler positions that you're going to need to fill, but you got to start thinking about it now and get them filled for the fall. But wait a few weeks after Easter because people are pretty tired.
Right.
And then
so there's the rhythm for you there.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, a couple weeks after Easter before you start lifting things. But the spring season does give you an opportunity
to do things as well, right?
Exactly. And to invite people into things. And there's just that sense of hope again and those things. So it's worth taking advantage of, especially in our climate, I guess.
A lot of churches do summer camp. Camp ministries is pretty huge for a number of churches. Is that something that's part of your guys' church's rhythm?
A lot of our families are very involved in summer camp, so we promote it and encourage it. And of course, the ministry that happens at camp is second to none in my view. I love the just so many people reflect back on their lives as summer camp being a life changer. So we do, but we don't have our own camp. So there's several great camps right around our community here that our people tend to go to. And then we as a church, we have kind of a neat rhythm in the summer. We don't really slow down our children's ministry or a lot of what we do. And our attendance really stays strong. We get a lot of guests as well through the summer. So it's an interesting season for us, but we do try to, especially for our staff, lighten the load through the summer. And then one of the ways we do it is we try to make summer just a little more fun. So we have a whole theme we call Summer at Victory. We do giveaways every week of like ice cream sandwiches or free televisions.
Laptops.
Yeah. We place bets every week at this service.
No, car keys under your chair.
No. We have fun giveaways.
And you get a car.
Sir. Okay. mostly for the kids, but then the adults get involved too. And we'll do various outreaches, a carnival or things like that. Things that are fun. Exciting. There's still work for sure.
Do you guys get involved in sidewalk days?
We do.
Because you're right on Main Street.
Yeah, and we go pretty wild for sidewalk day. Yeah. We're about, that's one of our biggest outreaches.
I think I went by, you guys gave me water once or something.
Yeah, it takes literally well over 100 volunteers and hundreds and hundreds of hours of our team.
For our listeners who don't know, every year Moose Jaw historically, for decades and decades has hosted Sidewalk Days on Main Street in Moose Jaw. And it's a full-on day, or sometimes it's multiple days strung together where people put their everything out on the street, and it's great. It's good walkable space. And
I mean, the city of Moose Jaw is only 35,000 people, and we'll get like thousands and thousands of people out to Sidewalk Days.
So I mean, that's great to have that involvement during the summer.
It sure is.
So any advice we would give to churches, what should churches be focused on in this season besides volunteer preparation for the fall? Anything else they might work on? You mentioned Pentecost Sunday. What is that?
Well, it's a special time for the church, right? To celebrate the work of God's Spirit in our midst, and also the mission of the church, right? Being sent forth to be a witness.
So not every church follows the church calendar closely, but I mean, you're from a more of a charismatic Pentecostal tradition. Is Pentecost Sunday have a special place for you folks? Do you do something unique?
I think it historically probably did in our church.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily. I mean, we have series going on and so on, but it is likely that on Pentecost Sunday that's referenced and part of our worship and part of our experience. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool.
I think at our church, every Sunday is Pentecost Sunday.
So. That's right.
You're not limiting the Holy Spirit to one day.
That's right.
That's good.
honoring Pentecost Sunday in its
funny enough, so just that makes me think. Like I preached last Sunday, you guys were away, right? But I preached last Sunday on it was the Sunday after Easter, and it was make every week Easter Sunday.
Okay,
so there you go.
Every week is Easter. It's Christmas.
Pentecost. It's the whole deal. Every Sunday.
That's called the gospel. Incarnation, crucifixion, resurrection, glorification. That's 1 Corinthians 15, folks.
Yes.
Well, this week on the podcast, we have Cody Matchett, and he is a Briarcrest alum, but he is now today an author, speaker, and a ministry leader from Calgary, Alberta. And we're going to be talking about a lot of subjects, but we've spent a lot of time talking about theological education in the church. So that's going to be one of the, I think, one of the more central themes that's in our conversation together. So I hope our listeners find this helpful and challenging for them as they partake. Guys, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Church in the North is a production of Briarcrest College. We love hearing from our listeners. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, or if you have questions, our email address is podcast@briarcrest.ca. If you like what you're hearing, leave us a review, share your comments, or hit that subscribe button for more content north of the 49th parallel. Stoked to have with us Cody Matchett on the Church in the North podcast. He is an author, he's a speaker, sometimes scholar from Calgary, Alberta. He's a dad and a husband and a disciple of Jesus. And Cody, welcome to Church in the North.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. It's really great to be here. Appreciate you having me.
So I want our listeners to kind of get up to speed on who you are and a little bit about your ministry journey. So why don't we start back in the beginning when the Earth's crust was still forming? I can say that I'm older than you are, but
you are. That's why I'm thinking. I think it's funny. People are going to think I'm much older than I am now.
Let's start with your education and your start in ministry. You have an interesting story because you didn't actually begin with this, you know, coming out of high school, wanting to go into Bible college or ministry. So give us your background.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up like lots of kids, you know, doing sports, maybe unlike lots of kids, but like lots of kids doing music, also doing theater. And then when I got into high school, there was sort of a two-path option. You couldn't really, I went to a high school that had a great arts program. So you couldn't really do like sports and arts at the same time.
Okay.
I opted for arts. Because, you know, why not? And so I did a lot.
Weren't the quarterback from Glee? The guy did both.
I think that anyone who's ever seen me knows that that's not the case. I chose the arts route, which I did a lot of theater and a lot of music. I did competitive improv, competed nationally at improv, did all of those really fun things. And so then coming out of high school, I applied for programs to do theater and arts. That's what I did. I was a first year university student doing theater, and I had experience of Jesus. I don't know how to quantify it. I'm not even sure I still have a grid for it. We could call it apocalyptic. That's what Paul calls it. But yeah. I had a God experience, and I didn't really know what to do with it. And I didn't have a strong background in faith or belief. I don't come from a family that has any of that. I wasn't raised going to church or in a Christian home. And so I left the theater and arts program after that first year and tried to figure out kind of what to do next, and spent a few years living with some friends, and then eventually got swindled into applying to Briarcrest, got convinced that I should apply to Briarcrest College. And so I did, and I initially came to do worship arts and arts ministry because that was like my background for so long. And then through a convergence of experiences in my first year, which were pretty rough, because of the background I was coming from and and sort of trauma and baggage that I was carrying, but also my lack of familiarity with being in the kind of environment that Briarcrest is, led to some issues and problems in my own life where it led to, you know, therapy, but with therapy, lots of reexamination. And I found myself in a class on John's Gospel with Wes Olmsted. And it was there that I had, I would say, like a kind of second experience of God. And I heard the voice of Jesus, you know, my sheep hear my voice and they follow. And something happened in that class. Again, I don't have a grid for it other than it was a type of spiritual encounter that then sent me on this interesting journey of wanting to learn and grow and read scripture and know scripture better. And so I switched to become a biblical studies major at the end of my second year and took kind of every class in that regard I could. I was not the best student by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay. That's good to know.
But I was just so curious and wanted to learn and wanted to grow and just had the immense privilege of learning from people, you know, like Wes Olmsted and David Miller and Susan Wendell. And it was so influential on me. All of my sins remain my own. All of my blunders are not on them. They're on me. They're really great. And so from there at Briarcrest, and we'll come back around to this, I'm sure, in a minute, I stuck around for a few years kind of working at Briarcrest and then transitioned to doing a master's in New Testament at Northern Seminary under the direction of Scott McKnight. And then I'm a year now into a PhD program in New Testament. I live in Calgary, but I'm a distance student through Ridley College in Melbourne, Australia. And so I'm studying with a guy called Michael Bird and Brian Rosner. So I'm doing PhD work now. But I'm also, as we'll come back to, I'm a church person. So I'm continuing to do this thing of wanting to discover. I can't seem to quench that insatiable curiosity about Jesus and scripture and our faith that was nurtured in that class at Briarcrest. And so I keep moving forward, not because I think I'm the smartest student, but I just have a lot of questions and curiosities that I keep trying to track down. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's kind of the educational journey.
Yeah. So failing student to PhD. Listen, there's hope for everybody.
Yeah.
Everyone who's listening, any Briarcrest students or any other theological students across the country, you can keep going. Just keep going. So you eventually, you became the chaplain at Briarcrest. How did that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up through a convergence of events being student body president in my last year at Briarcrest. And that put me in an office next to a person who remains a mentor and great friend to me to this day, Dan Gabor, who is the former dean of students at Briarcrest. Mm. And Dan and I had this great relationship. And Dan was a pastor to me and a friend and a mentor to me. And upon graduation, Dan had asked me if I would be willing in a sort of hybrid in recruitment, in student development, kind of sticking around. So that was my first year. I was in a student development and in recruitment. And then in my second year, I transitioned to fully being in student development and working with Dan. And that's when I became the college chaplain. So not my first year, but my second year being on staff at Briarcrest. Yeah. Hmm.
Now you almost planted a church the Evangelical Covenant Church. Tell me really quickly the story of you getting from chaplain to almost church planting.
From failing student to failing church planter. I didn't know this was going to be this podcast, Rob. What are you doing to me here, man?
We came
to the end. So I got married in my time of being on staff at Briarcrest, and my wife completed her master's in counseling at the seminary, and there was always this impetus and movement and draw towards church planting, you know, being a part of nurturing communities. You did this, Rob, so many people who come to know Jesus for the first time, it happens in a church community that is around 5 years old or younger. Mm-hmm. And so there's such a missional movement to these communities where we have the opportunity to not just do our own thing, but to come in and actually be a part of doing what exactly we see the Apostle Paul doing in the book of Acts and getting into communities and cities and planting and working. And so we felt the call to plant a church. And so we, when we felt like our time, like Bree's time with her degree and then kind of my time and my role was coming to an end, we began a discernment process for figuring out what we would do next. We knew part of that process was that I would do my master's because Bree had finished hers. But then it was trying to figure out how we would plant, where we'd plant, where we would go. And so we got in touch through some friends with the Evangelical Covenant Church of Canada, ECCC. And began a discernment process with them for planting. And we went through the process. We were approved. We went through the litany of things that you go through to have that approval, from a rigorous interview process to they adjudicate preaching and you do marriage counseling. And I'm sure you know all of this. But all that whole, we went through all of that. And then we had started to have gatherings here in our community. We had started fundraising and doing the work that you do as church planters to build your core team and to kind of build your budget and to find your location and place and all of those things. And then COVID-19 happened. And
hard to plant a church.
It's hard to plant. Yeah. So we were faced with an interesting question, which was, do you want to be an internet church? And there's nothing wrong with being an internet church. There's nothing wrong with starting that way and then going to in person. But we just had a lot of people who really love, they got on board as a part of our core team out of that idea of like being, you know, missional and organic and central to our city. And being online was not what any of us dreamed or imagined or hoped for. And I'm not even sure my ecclesiology has really worked out what internet church means or what it means to stream all of our services. I think there's lots of really complex and important questions that people like you and others are asking and should be asking. And so we had to put it on pause, and then pause, as you remember, turned into house arrest, and then house arrest turned into a certain number of people, but then more people, but then house arrest again. And so it was a funny convergence of experiences where, yeah, we just had people saying, listen, we can't give money that we said we would give, or we can't donate at this time because, you know, we don't know what finances look like. And then for us asking that, those questions that I think many of us asked during COVID of like, well, what do we do now? How do we adjust in such a way that offers an appropriate response? Recognizing that like we heard correctly, we went through a discernment process. Other people validated that. There were hands laid on us and prayed for us that this was the thing we were to do. And then we were in a situation where we couldn't do it anymore. And so I felt like, and Bree felt like, through kind of prayer and consideration, we had to ask the question of like, well, what do we do now? How can we have positive impact for the church right now in this sort of tumultuous circumstance that we're faced with? And so eventually through the stops and starts, stops and starts, it went on pause, and then pause became permanent pause. So it's funny. I'll often say that I'm a failed church planter, and people will often push back on that and say, well, that's not really true because it never really got off the ground. And the convergence, you know, the reasons why it didn't happen were not really on you. And all those things are true. But I think it's been good and important for me to recognize, hey, yeah, we set out to do something. And the thing that we set out to do is not what happened. And not because we didn't hear correctly or because we weren't obedient. We were obedient. And I think we heard correctly. It's just the world shifts and moves and turns. And sometimes it requires a different response at a different time.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of that experience. And I it was a hard experience. It was really challenging, dark for all of us, and then dark in different ways when you feel like there was a sort of, to use a funny proverbial phrase, like a God-sized dream in your heart that you were pursuing and you were giving all your labors and efforts to that all of a sudden wasn't going to happen. And so it was a dark season for sure. It was a difficult season for sure. But I found, you know, it's interesting how these things happen, right? The scriptures are the scriptures. But when we bring our seasonality to them, we see things in them that maybe we didn't see before. And sure. I think maybe it was the first time that I saw Paul with clarity, where Paul is like laboring for people that he loves and trying to do this work. And more often than not, it seems like it's not necessarily succeeding. Or people want to choose the the celebrity preachers and pastors over Paul, the so-called super apostles, you know, and Paul's offering this sort of reverse CV, if you will, where he's saying, listen, you want to know what apostleship it's like? It's like being shipwrecked, and it's like being beat, and it's like being thrown to the ground. And so I think that I found a companion in Paul in that season, in a way that I had not found a companion in Paul before. But I'd be lying if I said it wasn't really challenging. It was, like it was for many of us in that season, of trying to, as we said many times, pivot or adjust or figure out what it looks like to be faithful.
Oh, yeah. I hate that word. It's so triggering, pivot, as somebody who pastored COVID. Yeah. Well, you know, that word failed church planter. I mean, it's it can mean so many things. I mean, because a lot of church planters who didn't, their church plant didn't last. Let's just say that. I mean, there were mitigating systemic factors that contributed to that as well. I mean, and even if it wasn't a pandemic, it could have been something else. Loss of a certain group, loss of a building, loss, you know, there's so many other factors that are there. So
it's certainly a volatile experience, and it presents all sorts of challenges in the best of circumstances, as you're describing. And I think too, like for anyone listening who's been through that experience, like I'm with you, and I think it provides us some great opportunity to remember why we're in ministry. It's and why we're responding to a call, and to refine whatever in us needs to be refined. Not because God made this thing happen, but because oftentimes circumstances just happen, and we're invited to respond to those circumstances. At least that's what it was for me.
Yeah, yeah. So from there, your next step in your journey was you ended up at First Assembly in Calgary. A Payoc church, our Payoc brothers and sisters. What was your role there, and how did that, how did you end up going from church planter apprentice to, you know, to whatever your role was?
Yeah. I had a good friend in the city who is still on staff at First Assembly here in Calgary. And so when I moved here, he and I connected and became fast friends and remain close friends to this day. And, you know, he just said to me, somewhat funny, you know, maybe in the moment, like if I were to look back and laugh, maybe lacking a little bit of tact, where he was like, hey, listen, man, if that's not going to work out, if that church planting thing's not going to work out for you, like, I'd love to hire you. And it was kind of that funny experience of like, hey, if that's not going to work, why don't you come over here and do some work for us? And it was a bit of a recognition when I first went on staff at First Assembly that I have this interest for the kinds of education that you and I have experienced, and for seeing biblical or theological education being a central part of church communities. And so First Assembly had launched a ministry school, not accredited, just trying to target individuals who wouldn't go to like an Ambrose or a Briarcrest or a Miller or somewhere else, but people who are going to go to like U of C or somewhere else in the city, or maybe they just came right out of high school and did a trade job or something else, who are never going to go have that formal biblical experience, to say, how do we create a kind of track program for them over a couple of years where they can be apprenticed into some basic things of like how to read the Bible and what are spiritual disciplines and what does it look like to have a rule of life, and how do we do kind of be on mission together, and what is community and some of those things. And so, you know, one of my jokes, and I've said this many times to others, and I'll say it to whoever's listening now. One of the things I've joked about with my my Payoc brothers and sisters, of which I am one, so like, you know, that sometimes they're really good at getting people together, and they don't necessarily have a plan for what to do with them once they get them together. It's just this, like, the Spirit will do it, you know? And I love that. Yeah. Like, that's charming to me, and I believe it. Yeah. But also, I'm that proponent of like, well, if we're going to have a ministry school, we should have more of a structure. And more of a sort of a structured outline for how this is going to operate and what life together looks like. And so they had done a year of that ministry school, and it was wonderful. And they had all of the preliminary building blocks in place. But what they were really lacking was maybe some of the more academic portions of how these classes would run, the curriculum would run. And so they brought me on to do some of that work initially with the ministry school. And then that just sort of snowballed into being asked to do some other things, some teaching at the ministry school, also in conjunction with the work that I was doing. And then that became, hey, can you be the assistant director? And in their mind, assistant director, you teach and you do kind of academic-y stuff. So in their mind, it would be like an academic dean for this kind of ministry school. And then that turned into being asked if I would come on staff as a pastor of teaching and formation for the church as a whole, to try to do some of the work that I'd been doing here across the church as a whole. And so it was a kind of snowball effect over those 2 or 3 years, where once this other thing had ended, they asked me if I'd be willing to help in some of these other areas. And all of that was while I was doing my MA. And so it was right. a part-time experience, you know, part-time MA, part-time doing some of these other things. And so that's kind of how I got involved there and remained there now to this day at this point.
Okay. Well, and we're going to come back to this later, but I mean, you also wrote a book during this time while you were there.
Yeah.
Was that just really quickly, was that right after your MA or was that during your MA?
It was during my MA process.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we'll talk about that a little bit more, but so now your role has shifted yet again with First Assembly. What are you doing lately? Tell us, give us a snapshot of that.
Yeah. So all of that work then transitioned and culminated in, I, again, part of this process where I got to be a TA for a couple of scholars at Northern, Scott McKnight, of course, who was my thesis supervisor, and then Nijay Gupta was also there. I was a teaching assistant for him. And it was during that time that they had both encouraged me to consider doing PhD work and PhD studies. And that wasn't honestly on my radar. Again, like, I love to learn. I love to be a part of theological education, but doing a PhD, in my mind, I think of like the people whom I deeply admire, the people who are formative to me, someone like a Wes Olmsted or a Susan Wendell or a David Miller. I'm like, well, I'm not on their level. So I'm not sure that's, you know, the greatest of ideas, but Scott was really encouraging towards me, in the process of working with him and then writing this book together to consider that. And so I got to the point of saying, yeah, that's the thing that I'm going to do. And then applied for PhD programs and we settled on this work. And then I resigned from First Assembly / became a kind of scholar in residence. So while I'm doing my schooling, still being around, but not being on the official staff team, but then being contracted to teach at our ministry school. So I'm considered internally like our sort of professor of Bible or theology for our ministry school.
Yeah.
But I'm contracted to do that. And then I'm also again, doing my PhD. Work at the same time. So I'm a PhD student who also teaches some classes and does some speaking. And then if that sounds glamorous to anyone, which it shouldn't, I spend the other part of my time with my two children who are 2.5 and 1. So that keeps me the most grounded.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you're a busy family man as well, which is totally
best.
Cool. Yeah. Let's have a conversation about theological education in the local church. You're obviously an advocate for it, given what you're doing. Why is theological education important for local churches?
Yeah, I think I want to say up front, I think we're the church goes through, as you know, like the church has gone through many changes and transformations, and the church is aiming to respond to the moment that it's in faithfully at any given time. And I think that we had some great missional movements. We had some great leadership-esque movements that emerged in recent years in the church. And those are all great things. So before I say anything else, I want to say, like, I think like one of the things I've learned from Paul is that he's a pragmatist. And it doesn't matter if it's big or small, styles vary, traditions vary. If Jesus is central and we're learning to follow Jesus together, that's the main piece. I think for me, what has become really important is thinking about what it means to be a pastor scholar or a pastor theologian. Some people will mix all of those words around, theologian, pastor theologian, whatever. It doesn't matter to me where you put the words. But that one of the things I realized, Rob, was that for most of church history, people who pastored churches, like priests and leaders of congregations, were also scholars and theologians. Most of the people we read, whether it be patristics or in the medieval ages or even beyond that, they were never people who just taught at universities or just taught at colleges, but they were also people who were deeply involved, boots on the ground in church life. So they were writing treaties. Sometimes their sermons were their treaties. Nobody would go for that today in a 30-minute three-pointer. Right. You know, you get into some of the Edwards stuff and you're like, there's 75 points in this sermon and it's at least 2 hours long. I'm not advocating. I'm not advocating for that, by the way. I think one of the things that I've just realized is I wanted to be, again, an embodiment of that. You know, doctors of the church, people who do scholarship, but are also pastors who recognize that not everybody does have the experience of getting to go to a Briarcrest or an Ambrose or a Miller or somewhere else. But they're just they're people who live in our cities, who live in our communities, who work faithfully, who love Jesus faithfully, and they need to be taught. Like, they need people in their community who can do the work of the learning or the PhDing or the DMinning or whatever that is, to be the presence of the person who can help them become the ancient word, of course, is catechized. They can become catechized in the way of Jesus. They can learn to be a faithful follower of him. And so, right, I think I just become an advocate of, like, if the word mathetes, which we typically translate as, you know, disciple or apprentice, the word means learner. Part of what we're to be is we're to be learners. I mean, in Matthew 11, right, we love that, come and rest with me, you know, take my yoke upon you. We love that part. Yeah. But Jesus says, come and learn from me.
Yeah.
Come and be my student. And so I think for me, it's the opportunity to do theological education and teaching in church context that is rigorous and robust, but accessible. However imperfectly, I'm sorting out how to do that. And I think for me, that's become just really important. So a good example, last fall, I taught 200 adults in our church through Romans on Wednesday nights. And a big part of that class was not just me showing up to lecture, but it was very dialogical. Like, let's read a section of the text and let's talk about it together. And I came prepared with note packets every week, you know, 20 or 30 pages of notes, just too many notes that we're never going to get through. But each week, giving them the notes and saying, here's some extra work if you want to do it. But just being here as part of that journey, learning to read, learning to follow Jesus together faithfully. And I know that every pastor is trying to do this. So I'm not trying to say that they're not. But I also want to say that, like, not every pastor can do the same things that you or I have done. And some pastors are the pastors that, like, need to do the hospital visits. And some pastors are the pastors that need to do the outreach and the evangelism. And some pastors are the pastors that need to do the rigorous study. And then together we function as a body, right? That, you know, channeling the work of Paul here. So yeah, theological education has been really important. And I think in one sense, you know, Mark Knoll, remember that book, the Evangelical Mind, you know, like the first line of the book, the scandal of the evangelical mind is there is no evangelical mind. And you're like, well, that's not entirely true. But rhetorically, I see what he's saying, like pushing us to say, have we lost some of our depth? And have we become perhaps a little bit shallow and have opted in some ways for a kind of mastery and control over specific things rather than having maybe a bigger or more robust picture? I think all of those things are true. And I think I just want to be a part of theological retrieval in the church.
Yeah.
I hope that was coherent.
No, that's
great.
There's so much
that could be said.
I mean, and you already alluded to this already, you know, with the missional movement. So, you know, pushing back on that a little bit, you know, when we think about, say, disciple-making movements that are happening in the world today, right? Mm-hmm. These rapid mobilization disciple-making movements that are occurring, not connected necessarily to scholarship all the time, right? But connected to disciples who make disciples who make disciples who make disciples, and highly evangelistic, highly emphasizing the formation of leaders who can form leaders, right? And so and there are these movements that are happening, but there's no scholarship there, right? So, you know, reflecting on that, like I was reading Stephen Addison's book, Movements That Change the World. I don't know if you've touched on that.
No,
one,
I'm not familiar.
He's looking at the Methodist movement in the States. So this is something I'm reflecting on lately. And I probably shouldn't be because I work in an academic institution, but the Methodist movement
States,
like with Asbury, Francis Asbury. Mm-hmm. I mean, how was the West won in the US for Christianity? Well, it was the Baptists and it was the Methodists. And the Methodists were 18-year-old kids with barely a facial hair riding horseback from town to town to town, not necessarily highly trained, but trained on the job. Like that was the Wesleyan model. Mm-hmm. And yet
winning people on the frontier. I mean, and Addison pulls out the statistics of the movement of the Methodists, and you can see this bell curve of it reaching its apex at a certain year. Like, so it's going up and up and up, more and more people, more and more converts, baptisms, members of churches. And the one year where it reaches its apex and then it starts going down is the year where they required all clergy, because it was always a criticism of the Methodist clergy that they weren't educated, was a requirement of them all to be seminary trained and educated.
Interesting.
And then so all of the churches, that the nature of the sermons, the nature of all of that became, you know, high church, high education, high scholarship, but not really practical, right?
Yeah.
And not necessarily, you know, calling people to respond to the gospel and whatnot. And it really changed. And you can see the bell curve going the other way during that year. So I'm more of a balanced guy. Like I think both are important in tandem.
I'm with you.
But so I think we need scholars in churches. I mean, and there was a certain portion of people that need that. So anyway, give me some pushback on that. Like,
I could be Wesley back to you, right? And say, Wesley gathers his circuit riding preachers at one point and says to them, why are the people under our care not better?
Yeah.
And his answer is because we are not knowing enough and we're not holy enough. And that combination is what makes Wesley one of my heroes, you know, that it's not enough just to know. You know, I think of, I was in preparation for the interview, for whatever reason, it came into my head. Thinking about, you know, Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, which is a book that's older than me. But in that book, you know, he says, the world is not in need of more intelligent people, but more deep people. And I think that's what I'm getting at too. I'm not just talking about being scholars for the sake of, you know, highfalutin treaties and intelligence. I'm just talking about the kinds of proficiencies that allow us to have a depth of knowledge of who our God is and what it means to be here in the world. Yeah. And I think that sometimes the continuous pipeline of maybe regurgitating the same things over and over again, not that any of us are guilty of that, is not actually going to help people get, you know, catechized in the right kinds of ways. And I think too, working with young people so much, it's just fascinating to see I work with a lot of young adults in particular, and that they're, one of the things I notice inner city young adults right now, which is who I work with, is that a lot of them, they have fluency, like they can give you an answer for something that's like, here's what I believe about X. And if you ask them to come back to scripture or tradition or where that view comes from, they don't have the literacy or the capacity to do that. And then that's why for a lot of them, I think that their faith feels, it doesn't feel stable.
Yeah.
Because they don't necessarily know where they come from or necessarily how scripture pushes towards that. So I'm with you actually. I think reaching people is integral if we believe what we say that we believe. And I think that being like Paul, having these types of conversations with normal people in the agora and while you're working like that, those are so, so important. But at the same time, Paul is also clearly writing at a high level and he's pushing for these sort of deep theological premises. So no, I'm with you. I want both things. I think what I'm saying is I feel the call to be in communities as the pastor scholar or my community as a pastor scholar. And I would want to advocate for space for church communities to ensure that we have those types of people in our communities in the same way that we ensure that we have the missional person or the pastoral care person.
That
I think the idea of pastor being all things to all people, I don't know if it ever worked, but it certainly doesn't feel like it works right now in an age of, you know, speciality. Whereas we have, you know, pastors that can mobilize and equip people in really specific kinds of ways. So my dream is not that everyone becomes a scholar or a scholar pastor or whatever. That wouldn't be practical at all. We wouldn't reach anybody. It would just be a bunch of people in their rooms by themselves with too much social anxiety to go out into the world. That would not be helpful for any of us.
In school for a very long time.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I agree.
So, I think too, that's part of why I'm doing PhD while I'm still in the church, because again, that was part of our family decision of saying, I don't just want to go be in an ivory tower somewhere. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I have friends doing that and they're amazing people. I don't actually want to work in a seminary or in a university. I want to work in a church and be a part of rubbing shoulders with people who are like, wait a minute, say that one more time. You know, I've never heard that before. And I'm like, that's what I love to live there.
Yeah. Well, I think N.T. Wright is a good example of that. I mean, he has said it all. I keep one foot firmly planted in the church, one foot firmly planted in the academy. And he can therefore be a great bridge from one to the other.
It's my dream.
And you know, for myself personally, I mean, I've been in school my whole life. I mean, there's maybe a couple of years I took off. So, you know, a couple of graduate degrees and then my doctorate is just, I mean, I was doing ministry the whole time. And actually I found my ministry was all the more richer because I decided to do that, to continue to learn. And I think Wesley would say that too. He encouraged those riders to continue to be students. So as they're riding their horses, they're reading books.
Yeah, I know.
For the journey.
It's so wild.
Yeah, it's a different model. So what you're about is also discipleship. I mean, there's a discipleship deficit in churches. That's been something we've been talking about the last couple of decades. I mean, it's certainly one of the highly commoditized book markets that's out there. There's a lot of books about discipleship. Mm-hmm. How does what you're doing intersect with the formation of disciples in the local church?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, which is coming back to the question of, okay, well, what is the gospel? What is the story that we believe? How do we then learn to follow Jesus faithfully in the moment that we live in? And I think, you know, one of the arguments I've tried to make with my students over the last few years is it's going to be really difficult for us to navigate the present unless we're tethered to our past. Mm. And by that, I'm not advocating for a kind of nostalgia or like a recovery of Christianity from like the 1950s or the third century. I'm trying to say it's in becoming deep learners of our texts and our history, which is hard work, that we can actually know how we live faithfully right now. So yeah, I mean, even as I say, you know, pastor, scholar, pastor, at the end of the day, all of that is unto the end of helping people be faithful followers of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
And to know what it looks like to navigate the complex moment that we live within faithfully. So, you know, one of the things I said, you know, over the last year in particular, at some events we were at, the YWC events, is that I think for a lot of these young students, and I've alluded to this already, I think what I see in terms of their discipleship deficit is that we do a lot of our preaching and teaching just based on fluency. So here's the application, go do the application.
Yeah.
But then when it comes time for people to do their own fluency, oh, I don't know what to do in this moment.
Yeah.
They don't have literacy to back up the fluency. And so they can't be fluent because they're not yet literate. And so I'm trying to help with that literate thing so that they can be more fluent in learning to navigate the social complexities of 2024.
I appreciate your preaching because you're not just chewing the food for them and then spitting it out and say, here, please eat this, but you're allowing the text to preach itself and you're walking them through just kind of a fundamental exegesis of the text. And then therefore, you know, what does this therefore mean to us? So I found that very, very helpful.
That's kind. I think it's kind. I'm trying to think about preaching a little bit like a funnel, you know, like I think that Stanley's sort of model of like one point sermon is like a helpful reminder for all of us. So for me, it's always a little bit like a journalist. I try to do some of the complex stuff right off the top if I'm going to do anything complex. And then I try to just weed it down through the exegesis to like trying to say, you know, if the you've missed everything point or if there's one thing. Mm-hmm. So again, I think what I try to do sometimes is just to say there is complexity in here, but it's always whittled down to like, I think everybody could walk away, hopefully. Again, we're all still working on our process of public speaking.
Sure.
I think that people could walk away being formed with a particular idea or that they then have to, in partnership with the Spirit, figure out how that works itself out in their life.
Yeah. You know, as we think about, the future of the church in Canada, and we think about the formation of ministry leaders. I mean, Heimstra just came out with some stats. Rick Heimstra, he's with EFC and he's doing research there with them. 600 and something, we'll need 612 train ministry leaders every year for the next 12 years if we're just going to catch up.
Yeah.
You know, and I think about all the theological schools across the country, both undergrad and graduate, we're not producing that many. We're not even close to that. Like we're like 1/6 of that we're producing every single year in any given year. And then, you know, half of them are not lasting past the first 5 years. So we've got a resiliency challenge. So a lot of churches have turned to say, well, maybe there's new ways of forming future pastors and leaders. Yeah. And churches like First Assembly, like Beulah, like Northview and whatnot are saying, well, how do we create our own school, or how do we partner with educational schools in our own context? Is that kind of part of the process that you guys are working with there?
Yeah. I mean, you're speaking to, you know, I mean, they're not insider discussions, because as you've alluded to, like, I know Beulah's doing it. I know other churches in Ontario are trying to think about this too. Yeah. We are trying to think about something like what, you know, Nikki Gumbel and their team has done in the UK, which is like, you know, as pithy as it may be, like there's a Peter track and there's a Paul track. There's like, how do we help expedite this process of seeing people educated in important and deep ways, but also to be practitioners, not just to be, scholars or to go to seminary in the formal sense, but people who have done the trades, who then do this and they become bivocational or co-vocational.
Yeah, more diaconical roles.
Yeah, exactly. So we're thinking about that. Like, how do we partner with institutions? And I mean, for us right now, obviously at First Assembly, we're PAOC. So it's Vanguard is our school here in Alberta, is figuring out how do we establish these types of partnerships where we can bring that education to churches proper. And again, I don't want to speak for Briarcrest. I'm not in the internal workings of this, but like, I think even for Briarcrest, like the brilliance of bringing some of the incredible world-class faculty that's at Briarcrest to churches, I just think if you can begin to nurture that, which will take time, you will find what I've found, which is like, I have like out of those 200 adults in Romans, I probably have at least 50 who have asked me if I will do a more technical seminary level course that they would even pay to take. So like, if we can begin to nurture hunger, I think that we can see that type of education move, and then that can fund these other avenues of seeing people equipped in and through the local church. Because as much as I wish it were true, Rob, I just can't convince most of my people to move even to Edmonton from Calgary, let alone Karenport.
Yeah.
I love Karenport. I love Moose Jaw of blessed memory in my time. But I can't convince most people to make that move. And so again, I'm saying, well, how do we help people get a taste of these things, to see them get equipped in certain ways that they recognize that they just are pastors where God has placed them, and that how we see more of them equipped to find themselves in church roles. So a lot of our pastors on staff at our church or staff at our church are doing our ministry school and or doing classes through Vanguard or Briarcrest or other places. So they're doing their education while they're in church ministry. So they're learning, as you know, as I do, so much. And you learn the questions that you don't just ask when you're just in a classroom, but you're getting the experience that's actually going to form a deeper kind of knowing. And so, yeah, I think like you, I'm just arguing for both. Like, and I just think like, I can't help with all of the things, but part of what I want to help do is, you know, and being a teaching pastor and then, you know, teaching in the classroom also is just to help formation happen in this particular kind of way, knowing that we need more people on our teams to help it happen in more robust ways too.
Yeah.
But I think your question is exactly on point, is how do we help more people catch a vision for what pastoral ministry is like and what it means to be a pastor and to heed to the call of mission in this kind of way?
Yeah. And I think larger churches have a better opportunity to do it because,
I think you're right.
Well, you just have the capacity, you've got the space, you've got more specializations on staff.
And you have funds that other churches don't have. And again, like, I think, you know, a couple of my friends have quoted this to me, and it could be just folklore or wrong. So someone can send me an email to correct this. But I think, you know, people like a Eugene Peterson and others have just made the point of like, every church can't be everything. Mm-hmm. And some churches, and again, this is something that, you know, this is just full honest, right? Like, I think young people were like, the big churches, you know, like some people can just poo-poo on big churches. It's like, we need big churches and we need small churches in order to do all of these types of things collectively for the kingdom that God has called us to do. And yeah. So again, I've been really fortunate to be a part of the formation of a ministry school over these last years and continuing to dream about what that looks like because our church can afford that reality. And then to help create pathways, again, what we're thinking about, as I'm sure you are, for other churches to be a part of that, that can't afford to have someone like me on their staff or someone like you on their staff.
Yeah. Well, and I think schools are getting better at that. And I mean, COVID was great. It was a great bump for schools to start thinking about different models. Even here at our seminary, I think 90% of our courses are now online courses. And then the rest are modular and you can come and take them in person. I mean, it's always better to take an in-person course. It's always better to teach an in-person course. There's just so much about the embodied experience. However, if you're working in a full-time job and you got a family and you want to take a course and you're living in Calgary, an online option is a great option for you as a learner.
Absolutely.
And you're already, you may already be embedded in a community of learning where you're at or a community of formation where you're at. And so you don't need to come and do it here. Unfortunately, at the undergrad level, we don't have that available, but we have a greenhouse. That's the other thing, is you can come here in this amazing discipleship environment and grow as an undergrad, but
which is vital. I mean, it's so important. Yeah. And I would advocate for in-person education at every turn, even as someone who, because of COVID and other restrictions, has did their entire MA distance apart from one class.
Right.
And is doing a PhD distance. No, a UK model. So it's mostly research anyway. But nonetheless, I've had to, as you've described, create my own kind of learning pockets and environments here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate all that. Let me change the subject a little bit. You're working with Tequila. You work with a lot of emerging adults, Gen Xers, millennials and Gen Z.
Yeah.
What are you learning from working and teaching with this next generation? What can be helpful for maybe some of our ministry leaders who don't have that face-to-face involvement? What should churches be paying attention to? And maybe how do we contextualize the gospel to what we're seeing now, boots on the ground?
Yeah, I think I would first say whatever myth that's out there that the church is dying or that there isn't spiritual hunger, like I only see the opposite. I see lots of hope and I see growth and I see a lot of young people who are like really hungry to sort out what faith is really about and what it looks like.
Yeah.
So I would want to say that right off the top. You know, I see hope, I see hunger, I see all of those really great things. I think I also see, again, coming back to the previous point, maybe just a lack of a type of education or saturation education, where I think there's a recognition among many of them that they really want to believe, but often they don't always know why they believe what they believe. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a deep invitation in a moment where, you know, I know it's kind of catchy and kitschy, but where so much TikTok content or otherwise is about, you know, deconstructing or putting out the hard questions because the hard questions get views, or the scandalizing statements get the views, to be the kind of people who are familiar with that discourse that's happening and the hard questions that are being asked, and then to engage those yourself. Again, it's a form of apologetics, but I think deeper than that, it's a form of helping people construct and reconstruct faith in really healthy and good kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. I think to do that, though, we just have to be willing to ask the hard questions.
Okay.
And we have to be willing to recognize that we even sometimes have to defamiliarize ourselves with something that seems so obvious to us. So like we're moving, we just bought a house, so we're moving here in the city soon. And we've been living in this apartment for the last few years. And moving out of this, now that I know we're moving out of this apartment, I see things right now, knowing that I'm leaving, that I didn't really see before. Like I had become comfortable with the way that our house is and was, that maybe there's like a little dirt here or there, or a crack in the drywall here, or a hole over there, that now that I know I have to fix that or fill that, I'm very aware of it in a way that when I'm just living there, I can just sort of skate by it. I think that we have to know that when young people are reading these texts, so like I taught, again, 80 students through Torah last fall, man, they're reading Torah for the first time. They've got a lot of questions. And yeah. I think we just have to like be willing to like sit with those and journey with those and then defamiliarize ourselves with what we think all of those things are about to maybe see again with clarity what's really there. That's a hard journey. But I think it's a really rewarding one. And then maybe one of the things that I'm really sensitive to, Rob, and people can just say, well, this is just me. You know, what do you know about what you're talking about? I think the more we can pull ourselves away from some of the insider talk and some of the, again, assumed kind of Christianese ways that we speak, it will be really helpful for us. Because I think right now, if we think about recontextualizing, we need different language. That again, same gospel, same heartbeat. But we need to think about how we relay these things in ways that are not going to sound like we're marshaling out the same stuff that was used 20 or 30 years ago, but actually really asking those deep questions. So again, I think, again, what I see boots on the ground, this is obvious. Everybody's talking about this. Identity is a big one. Who am I? Yeah. Why am I here? Again, you know, those are the existential questions that we all ask. But coming back to then, what does it mean to be a human? What does it mean to live in this strange world? And I think sometimes we will just jump to robust theological categories rather than trying to work back to what are different angles and ways we can talk about these things that are going to be really helpful. Maybe it's using psychology or using sociology, or if it's using the angle of pop culture that we have now. Or I think we have to become, I think, students of pop culture in our historic moment to try to know how to navigate those things well.
Yeah. Which is good gospel contextualization.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, right. So we're talking often to speak about these issues from our frame, but we're not entering into the frame of the culture we're trying to reach and understanding them and then bringing the gospel in a contextualized way to those. We need to be good missionaries, good missiologists in our own culture, but we assume that because they live in the same country as us, or they live in the same street as us, or in the neighborhood as us, that we're actually speaking the same language when we're not.
You're exactly right. And then I think figuring out, you know, I'll often joke with my students, like Christianity isn't about doctrines. It's about a way of life, which is actually not true because that's a false dichotomy. It's both those things wedded together, of course. But I think, you know this, of course, and the data would back this up. Young people that I work with, they want to see how this impacts their real life, and they want to see it impacting their real life. And they want to see us modeling this as types that they can follow. And so I think just coming back to that, you know, Pauline notion of imitate me as I imitate Christ, or as he says to his protege Timothy, you know, become a model for the faith. I think those things become important. But the way you said it is more eloquent than I did, which is entering into their frame to contextualize back, as opposed to just pushing the frames we have sort of back on younger people right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you said that you're seeing a hunger, you're seeing a a greater desire. What does that look like?
Yeah, I think it looks like a lot of people right now coming back to faith, and or people just asking a lot of questions. I think that people recognize that there is a kind of social turbulence, at least here in my city. There's a kind of social turbulence that exists where they don't know what is real or true or right. And there is this kind of murky morality where people are just saying to them, well, whatever you want to do is right, and whoever you want to be is right. And I think that that's led to so much anxiety and hopelessness that people then start asking the questions about faith again that maybe they had stopped asking at one point in their life. So I see it with young people, but I also see it in our church as a whole. I think people are looking for hope. And I think they're looking for a groundedness and a rootedness in terms of those big questions. And so I see people coming all the time in droves to Tehillah and to our Sunday services, just kind of trying to find who God is and why they're here.
Yeah, maybe for our listeners, we should define what is Tehillah.
It's a Monday night citywide event that's been happening for 30 years. And it has a charismatic flavor, but it's non-denominational technically. So we have about, you know, 16 to 25 denoms on a Monday night. You know, maybe recently we're up to 600-700 students. So it's high school students and young adults that come.
Okay.
And it's, we do, you know, worship and ministry time and a teach. And it's really just about a gathering of the saints to encounter God together and to be on mission in our city together. And then it's like a lot of young adult events where it's like some just come because they want to meet other young adults. And that's a good thing too.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's been, it was birthed out of a type of, you know, the language we would use is revival that happened years ago, where at one point in Tehillah's history, it was like gym was packed during the hour before for prayer, you know, 500-600 people coming, people driving all over from Alberta to come to Tehillah. And it was a catalyst for lots of people to come to know Jesus for the first time. Yeah. And so it has this interesting history, and it continues to this day. It's, and then the ministry school is a part of that. So a lot of the people who are come to Tehillah, they stay at their own churches, but then they also come to the ministry school that's funded by Tehillah and First Assembly.
Hmm. Yeah. So, you have a kind of a counterpart in Edmonton, the Project. Are you familiar with the Project?
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. They're a little bit different though, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a church of their own. So like, you know, Reuben would be like the Project pastor now, and they would have kind of their own, we're, Tehillah is not a church. Like we say every week, we're not a church. We believe in the local church. In fact, we've taken another step, which is our lead team has decided, our Tehillah leadership team decided that we have a phone number that anybody can text and we will find churches in their area and connect them with pastors that we know in churches. So again, we don't just want people coming to an event on Monday night. We want to help get them that plugged back into the local church. So we do that every week. We try to get people.
Yeah, that's great.
Because people will say, Tehillah is my church. And we'll always be like, it is not your church.
No, no. And the challenge, though, is to leave Tehillah to go to a local church. The expression and the experience might be different, quite different than what they're used to.
Yeah.
But hopefully a maturing disciple will say, well, that's all right. That's
I think it does have a shelf life. And I think there are lots of people. So for example, we have a high contingency number of Catholics who come to Tehillah.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is because they get mass and then they get this kind of other low church spiritual experience. And I think both those things together for them are really meaningful, the two expressions that go together. So we get a lot of that also. A lot of people who aren't trying to make it their church, but just love the experience of being there.
Is part of the shelf life just, I guess, the leaving emerging adulthood? So in other words, you finish college, you get a career, you get married, you have kids. I mean, you kind of start feeling a little old at Tehillah after that, and you're like, it's time to move on.
I think that's part of it. And then I think the notion of like, I don't know, like, I don't know what your experience was like or other people listening, their experiences have been like. But I think even for me, like, I think at one point in my life, like loud music and a sermon and, you know, fun community, that was like, it was really spiritually enriching to me. And I've grown up now. Those things are great, but I also really love silence and I don't go to church to hear a 30-minute talk. And you know what I mean? Like, whereas one point I did, no, but I think that it's a shelf life because you recognize that like, oh, there's no discipleship element here. It's an experience that is formative and helpful, but it's supposed to be a catalyst. And we say that every week. It's a springboard back out for a season of your life, but it's not forever. We really push people getting discipled, getting integrated into local churches. Tehillah can't be their church.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you just got old, man. You just got old.
I know. I've been bald for a long time, but only old for the last little while.
Yeah. So while you were in FA... while you were at First Assembly, you were able to co-author this book. Let's get back to that. Revelation for the Rest of Us. It makes me think of Seinfeld. Festivus for the Rest of Us.
Yeah, come on.
A prophetic call to follow Jesus as a dissident disciple. What a great title. Talk to us about that. I mean, why does Revelation matter to the church today? Let's first talk about the book and its content. Obviously, you co-authored it with Scott McKnight. I want to talk about that, what that experience was like. But why Revelation? And why does that matter for discipleship?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we could just admit right off the cuff, Revelation is a strange book for most, for most church folk. And a lot of pastors, up until very recently, have either preached it from really, we'll say, interesting angles, speculative angles, or they've ignored it altogether. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we try to do in the book is say, how do we read Revelation as a manifesto for discipleship? So what does Revelation teach us about how we follow Jesus faithfully right now? And that sounds much more like the rest of the New Testament. So already there, we're maybe at a better place of like, what does this teach us about the triune God, the one on the throne and the seven spirits and the Lamb? How do we follow the Lamb, you know, as Gorman says in the subtitle of his book, you know, in uncivil worship and witness, you know, or as we say, how do we follow Jesus as dissident disciples? And the reason why we go with dissident disciples is because empire and Rome play such a big role in Revelation. You get to chapter 17 and 18 and you see Babylon, the woman. She is Rome or Roma, seated on Rome. And so part of what John's inviting us into by using a weird mix of apocalyptic and prophetic and Greco-Roman letter is he's trying to invite us to see what it's like to live as these seven churches in Western Asia Minor with the pressures of the empire pushing in on every side.
How do we
stay faithful to Jesus when we're being asked to give our political worship, or we're being asked to go to these feasts and festivals that worship the gods that the culture worships? And so I've borrowed this from Gorman as a kind of a distilled version, but I think Revelation, because it's apocalyptic, it's imagistic literature, it's supposed to actually, believe it or not, help us to control our fear, because we see that God is on the throne and that the Lamb has been slain and that ultimately victory belongs to God, that judgment is coming, but it's not yet come.
Yeah.
And it helps us to renew our commitment. That's what prophetic literature does, right? Hey, Laodiceans, you're lukewarm. Hey, you guys over here at Ephesus, you've lost your first love. Like it's critiquing. So it's inviting them to renew their commitment and then sustain vision. So control fear, renew commitment, sustain vision, vision for as we follow the Lamb faithfully, as dissidents of empire and the kingdoms of this world who are willing to dissent and willing to dissent even from allowing the Babylon creep to come into our churches. That's a whole other conversation, I suppose, but to mirror the practices of the world and to run on the metrics that the world runs on, to resist that movement, that we sustain our vision for becoming those who are anticipating and longing for the New Jerusalem, and that we witness, which is a key term in Revelation, to the victory of the Lamb, even when it feels like, you know, the beasts and the dragon and Babylon have won the day. So it's, you know, if I lost everybody on that, I'll just say it's a manifesto for following Jesus. It's just fun, apocalyptic, prophetic Greco-Roman literature that's laced with lots of charts and end time stuff for lots of people. But at the end of the day, I think we could all find common ground with Revelation if we could just come back to saying it's trying to help us see how we follow the Lamb faithfully, the one who slaughtered and standing. Yeah.
Yeah. The Lamb of the kingdom versus empire.
Yeah, and pretty much.
And its leaders. So dissident disciple today. So what does that mean? I mean, is it protest rallies and getting on Twitter and, you know, barking at the world? What does it mean to be a faithful dissident disciple today?
You know, I would want to flip it just a little bit, as I often do with my students, and say, well, let's first ask how the prophets were dissidents. Mm-hmm. And whilst they do have judgment oracles that relate to the nations, the prophets are most often first and foremost critiquing the people of God.
Yeah.
So there is a kind of descent toward compromise in the church, I think.
Right.
And I think that's compromised. I think so. And a willing for that kind of self-examination. And then I think from there, it's definitely not getting on Twitter, and it's not barking at people and making angry statements. That's not it. It might be a kind of protest, although I would want to know in a nuanced way what protests and what we mean by protesting and all of those types of good things. But I think it means that we're not, at the end of the day, maybe the image of a buoy in water that's just moving along with the current. And the current of church culture and the current of Canadian culture is moving in this particular direction, where you have maybe a Christian nationalism on the right and then you have ideological propaganda machines on the left.
Yeah.
And you are feeling the pull of any one of these things, or you're moving in the certain direction of cultural current, I think it invites you to stop and ask, what does it look like to get pledge allegiance to the Lamb?
Right. Right.
And then how we resist that kind of move towards both nationalism and propaganda machines. You know, one of the critiques of the book, you know, it's written for an American audience primarily. It's written with Zondervan.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot on Christian nationalism. And a lot of the critique that I received, especially as a Canadian, is, well, you go after the right, but you don't go after the left very hard. And there's some truth to that for sure. And there's also a lot of stuff was cut and moved to an appendix. You know, when you're an author, you don't have all the control in the world. But I have said to people, I think if I was writing in a Canadian context, I would focus probably more on the propaganda machines that emerge with the beast of the sea and the beast of the land, and the propaganda that the Roman propaganda in particular that reinforces empire and cults. I think we have lots of that in our context too, that we need apocalyptic vision to see it clearly.
Yeah. 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 And I think nationalism can be empire in many ways because it's a false gospel, and there's a certain amount of idolatry that can stem from high nationalism.
Absolutely.
Right. And we confuse the flag for allegiance to the Lamb. Right. Yeah. And they're not the same.
Yeah. So, I remember Willie Jennings saying, it's okay to be a citizen as long as you're a disciple citizen and not a citizen disciple. And I think that's a helpful paradigm. Discipleship comes first. Paul has a Roman citizenship, not afraid to use it, but he doesn't wave it around all the time. And he doesn't think that his identity comes from that. He sees that as emerging from being in Christ and being a citizen of the kingdom that comes forth from the heavens. Yeah, it's helpful.
So how did you end up writing it with Scott McKnight?
Great question. I don't know, Rob. I was a student of Scott's, and I went there to study with Scott, and he and I became friends, and he invited me to be a part of the book project and to help with research and then some of the teaching and then the writing and editing and all the things that come with that. So yeah, it was just, I'll just say, cause maybe this is an encouragement to ministry leaders and people who have particular kinds of giftings. I just couldn't believe that someone who had been teaching the New Testament for 40 years, who's written over 100 books, would invite me to be a part of a book project with them. Mm. And I've subsequently learned that Scott has been doing this his entire career. He's just been giving people some of his space, providing opportunity, allowing them behind the curtain to learn from him, how he does scholarship and academia and how he writes and his procedures and methods. And I think, for many of us, maybe we just don't, many do, but maybe many don't just bring the young people alongside and say, hey, I'm not just going to like give you the grunt work, but, and this is like, your name's going to be on the book and I want you to be a co-author. And so I felt incredibly blessed. I did lots of work. I wrote lots of stuff. I helped teach classes. All of that stuff is true. But I also was someone who just watched and got a master class from a master in doing the work that he does. And I learned maybe more from being a part of that project with Scott than maybe my entire MA combined in some ways. It was just, it was a true masterclass working with someone who's been doing this his entire career. So he saw something in me and provided an opportunity.
So how did you do it? I mean, he write certain sections and you write a response? I obviously haven't read the book yet. I mean, I'm going to, but I mean, or did you write all of it and then he just tore it up, or
we started research together, and so we did notes, and then we found a couple, a very few companion scholars that we would work with while we were working on our own readings with the Greek text. And so we worked the Greek text, and then we had a few people that we worked with that we would go to for reference, like, I'm a little bit confused here. What do kind of people say, but not going to all the secondary literature, just a little bit. And then that morphed into a class that we taught together on New Testament story. So, it was one of our MA classes on just the story of Revelation and thinking of New Testament texts from that lens of how does it fit within the broader canonical story also. And so that was the initial work. So I did some of the lecturing for that class. did the notes, did the slides, all the things. Scott and I worked together, and then that turned into the writing immediately after. Which, yeah, it would work one of a couple of ways. Scott would write something, maybe sometimes a chapter, sometimes significant portions, based on the work that we had already done, yeah. And then he would send it to me, and I would do tons of comments and track changes and notes and rewrite some sections and then send it back. One of the funniest parts, and I've learned that it was the same for Scott's daughter, Laura. Scott doesn't work with Google Drive. And so we just emailed Google Docs back and forth. true nightmares. True nightmares are formed. But it was a lot of reading and writing and sending back and forth. And then I wrote some sections and then Scott integrated them and worked with them as well.
Yeah, didn't he write Church Called Tove with his daughter? Is that
he did? Yeah, right? And then Pivot with his daughter also, which was the follow up.
Yeah, yeah. Did you find yourself having to change the language for a younger audience?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating experience to have written a trade book on Revelation as the first trade book you're a part of writing, because it's such a complex book. And so sometimes even just trying to describe what John's saying, when he says things like, well, it was the one king, but then the other king, and then the seven kings, and then the one that would not yet come. And you're like, there's no way to say this that's going to be less complicated on one level than what he's saying. So some of that was difficult to work against. But yeah, I think thinking about the flow of a book and the flow of an arc, like, you know, like we do with sermons, like what's the kind of arc we're working with here, and how do these chapters flow one into the other? And then how do we write? So I think what's fun for me is, because I do academic writing for PhD work and otherwise, but then I also write sermons. It was sort of a fun getting to try to hybrid some of those things of, like, again, working these things together in some ways. Yeah. So yeah, I just learned a lot from watching Scott, who has learned to write a turn of phrase over 40 years of writing, and having ways of tweaking things or taking something that I wrote and reworking it in a way that I was like, oh yeah, that makes a lot more sense of how one would frame a point like this, or to nuance it in a particular kind of way. Yeah. So again, working with Scott, who's been writing trade books since 2003, I think a Jesus Creed was his first move away from academic writing towards, public writing. And even there, he said to me on numerous occasions, I think the story's public, but he said, nobody would take that book. Mm. And they just said, you don't know how to write. And some people said, have you ever even written a book before? And Scott had written like 15 or 20 academic books at that point. But their writing style was so different. And so what Scott did, which is really interesting, he gave me this advice too. At that point, he read every time before he wrote, he read 4 pages of Mere Christianity. And he said, I'm trying to pitch at the level that this book is written. And so his advice was like, find those books that really do hit the audience, and then also have your person in mind. So when I was writing, I was always thinking about my wife, who doesn't read dense theology and isn't just going to pick up any random book on Revelation. And I was thinking, how can I write a book in such a way that, like, Brie would want to even pick it up and read it, and it would make good sense to her. So having an audience or a couple of people in mind was also really helpful.
Yeah. Or write in a coffee shop. That's what a lot of people do for sermons is,
yeah, of course,
you're thinking about your audience who's surrounding you. For those who don't know Scott McKnight in his work, I mean, he's one of the foremost, if not the foremost, American theologians that we have today. So, I mean, what a great honor and privilege to work with him. But I do find his writing is accessible. It's going to be accessible to pastors and to people in our pews who are interested in reading what he has to say. So, I mean, one of the most impactful works I've read in the last decade was King Jesus Gospel. Just nice. brilliant book.
It's a great book,
and very formative for us in the West as we reflect on what is the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've benefited from his work too. And I can say nothing but praise for Scott. I'm just, I was a fan of his, and that's why I wanted to study with him. And now it's funny that he's a mentor and also a friend that I text sometimes about things. So,
yeah. Yeah. Great. What a great honor. And, what a great gift, to be able to do that. Well, Cody, I think our time's almost done here. I wonder if you could share a final word of encouragement for maybe ministry leaders who are listening in today.
Can I just cheat and read Paul?
Is that okay? Absolutely. Absolutely.
I just want to cheat. I'm just going to cheat, everybody.
Love it.
Forgive me.
Love it.
My dissertation work is in 1 Timothy, and so there's lots of great advice in 1 Timothy. But the really famous words, which I've already alluded to, 1 Timothy 4:12, let no one look down on your youth, but become a model of faith in your words, in your behavior, in love, in faith, and in devotion. Until I come to you, keep yourself reading in encouragement and in teaching. Don't neglect the grace act that was given to you through prophecy when the elders laid hands on you. Focus on these things, be in them, so that your advancement may be apparent to all. Hold to yourself in the teaching, remain in them, because in doing this, you will save not only yourself, but also those hearing you.
Amen. Good word.
Amen.
Thanks for joining us, Cody. We'll have to get you back on the Church in the North at a future date.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob. It's been a great privilege to chat with you.
You've been listening to the Church in the North podcast, a production of Briarcrest College. To learn more about Briarcrest, visit briarcrest.ca. We all know that when something is good, it's worth sharing. So why not pass on today's episode to a ministry leader or someone who will find it helpful? Also, don't forget to leave us a review, share your comments, or hit that subscribe button. We love questions and suggestions, so email us at podcast@briarcrest.ca. And for more information about the podcast and our hosts, visit churchinthenorth.ca. Thanks for listening. Until next time.